Most of us want to be more productive in our lives. That is, we want to cause what we want to cause. We want to create those things that seem meaningful to us. We want to be more useful. We want to be healthier, happier. We want to take actions to produce those conditions in our lives. Today, I want to talk about the connections that we may have made between our actions and other emotions that may not serve us. Specifically today, the connection between action and regret. I'm wondering if you, like me, have had this feeling. Have you ever felt that when you extend your energy, on the one hand, you're also trying to pull it back or withhold it on the other? You know, this has been referred to over time as pulling our punches. It's a kind of a tentative commitment of our energy. We want this, but we're very quick to judge it, and we're afraid that it, in fact, is going to result in negative consequences, which we would ultimately end up regretting. So this tendency to commit our energy in a bidirectional way is a way to disadvantage ourselves. So it is that idea that I want to talk about. Having this action hyphen regret pattern, and that's how I'll refer to it, makes taking action more difficult for us, because if we have associated regret with action and we see those things being a kind of a 1-2 combination, that regret is going to be something that we're seeking to avoid. And if we misconclude that the action produced a regret, then we're going to seek to avoid taking the action. Regret about an action that we've taken can be looked at from the standpoint of judging the action that we've taken not being optimum. Well, what is an optimum action? You can recognize that what's optimum at one moment, when we have a little bit of information more, either minutes later or hours later or the next day, because we have more information now, a greater understanding of consequences, how that played out, we would look at it and judge that experience and the results of those actions as being not optimum. Well, we didn't have that information available to us when we took action the first time. So that idea of judging afterwards is really a very big problem with how we see things. Pretty much any action can be judged as not optimum, and so it depends on when it is judged. If we judge it immediately afterwards, it's very easy to do, but this idea that we're going to judge it or hold it up and be, you know, kind of like a Monday morning quarterback, which is a common expression here in the United States, where a person is referring to a football game that got played on Sunday, now is making judgments on what could have been done, should have been done, would have been done, that sort of thing, or what should not have been done. And the other expression that's really common to us is hindsight is 20/20. Looking back at an experience, it's like, oh, well, now I understand how it was going to play out. I knew now, at this point, I know what's going to happen now that it's already happened. That's really easy to see after the fact. So one of the questions is, how do we improve the quality of our actions? Well, one way would be to define our goal. Before we take the action, what is it we're trying to accomplish? What are we trying to achieve? What do we want to create? What output, outcome, result do we want? And then, once we define that, actually deciding to achieve it is a second step. A lot of people don't recognize that as being an important part of it, but that's deciding to achieve it is the commitment of energy. That's, instead of being bidirectional, it's unidirectional. That is, all full steam ahead. And if we don't feel like we can do full steam ahead, it's because we still have reservations about the decision and about the definition of our goal. And if that is the case, then what we're going to want to do is not take action until we further define it. And when we can define it in such a way as we can commit to it, we can decide to achieve it, then we are almost ready to take action. What I would recommend is a third step is to notice the emotional state we happen to be standing on as we're viewing our goal and our decision. And recognizing that our view of ourselves, of life, of opportunity, of God, of other people, is dependent on the emotional state in which we are in. Those emotional states really serve as filters, so our perceptions are going to be colored by the emotional state. A person who is trying to take action from grief or fear is taking a different quality action, more preventive than causative, than a person who is at a much higher level of courageousness or acceptance or peace. So if we can recognize where we are, and before we take action, seek to shift our emotional state as high as we can get it. The ideal place before action is to get into courageousness. This is a place of discovery, of enthusiasm, excitement. It's very engaging for us. It's very open. It's very learning and discovery oriented, and it also enrolls other people to support our activities. And then, from that place, take action. And our ability to achieve desirable results are far greater, and our chances of producing regret are far less. What seems to happen when we react to whatever's happening, based upon whatever emotional state we happen to be standing in, is that emotional state gets triggered, and the fear energy is what we feel is when we act from that place, it gets released. When we release that fear energy, the adrenaline, the cortisol, if I were talking in terms of hormones or body chemicals, that when they get released, we experience a sense of relief. So it's almost as if on a primitive level, we're being encouraged to release the energy to get back to a normal state. But if we act from a lower vibrational state where our awareness is limited, because we can't see other choices other than fight or flight, that once we have that energy released, we're going to experience relief, and then all of a sudden other choices on the menu are going to appear to us. We're going to all of a sudden recognize that, oh wow, now that my perceptions have improved, I see alternatives to those two choices of fight or flight. I could have approached it this way, I could have done this, I could have not done that, I could have... All of that stuff becomes available to us after we come out of stress. The trouble is, if we've already acted, now we have the consequences of those actions. And for most of us, we've been trained to judge our actions after the fact and find fault with them. What this means is that if we can recognize that this tendency, and some of us have a more hair-triggered tendency than others, is that when we are reactive, that is when an environmental signal comes in and it triggers some threat to our needs, at least perceived by us as that, that we're going to react. If we can delay that reaction for a nanosecond, a half a second, 1 second, and be able to involve the conscious mind, our thinking, our reasoning capabilities in this process, instead of reacting primitively based upon what we've learned over the course of our lives and perhaps over our generations, is that consciously we can choose our responses. We can choose how we respond rather than instinctively reacting. And those conscious choices would be more in alignment with what we have decided we want. At a higher emotional state, we can realize that effectively moving energy is the goal. Effectively moving energy. That's what we're moving energy all the time. Whether we're doing it effectively or not is another question. It's effective on some level, to some degree. Is more effective or is less effective. And the goal of the game is to move energy more effectively. And the way we know we're being more effective is we're producing more happiness and joy for ourselves, and by extension, for other people. Taking action is not about perfection. It's about becoming increasingly effective. If we look at the model of immature thinking and what an immature thinker sees and how they behave, we might see how regret often accompanies actions. So the immature thinking, this is a three-step model. If you can imagine, the first step is the emotion. The second step, based upon that emotion, is action. And the third step is decision. So this is how it could play out. We could say that an immature thinker interprets an emotion as being sufficient information for action. Kind of like this. I have this feeling, therefore I must take this in this action, or I must take this not action, just because I have this feeling. Now, you will be able to recognize in your own life that thought process. I think it's common to us as human beings. So if we think an emotion is sufficient information on which to base action, we now will take that action. And if we develop the habit of taking and using emotion as the deciding factor of our actions, now all of a sudden we recognize that we've eliminated the ability to reason, our thinking capability, our intellectual capacity from this process of trying to achieve our goals. We're basically an emotion reaction kind of thing. And over the centuries, the millennia, we have developed a reasoning capability that we didn't have as cave people. So if you can see that this, the case of the emotional energies driving our decisions, could lead a person to practicing impulsivity, instant gratification, the emotions ranging on the lower level from shame up to pride, and depending on our emotional state at the time of the action, we will either have to create or use a lot of justified thought as a third step. This is that decision step, a lot of justified thought in order to make our behavior seem okay to us. Oh, well, I had to do it because of, they were different than me, and we'll go through a lot of that justification in order to release some of the anxiety that we would have caused ourselves by our actions. Or, if we're not able, or we're wise enough, or sensitive enough, and justified thought is not going to work, we'll have different thoughts on how the situation could have been handled, and regret can show up that we didn't choose a higher vibrational level action. This cycle of emotions dictating our actions really continues. It's almost like a loop, action hyphen regret scenario. For example, if I have a feeling and I take an action based upon that, and instead of being able to justify it, I feel regret, I will then use the regret, those emotions, now to take non-action. That non-action is action, just like not making a decision is a decision. Action and inaction are both actions, just two different types, two different powers, two different directions. In ideal family conditions, children would have been helped to understand that as we develop our awareness and become better thinkers, we would transition from being driven by emotions to being driven by our logical, reasoned, well-thought-out, mindful decisions. And we would be effectively coached along this path in a highly functioning family of origin. In the less than ideal family upbringing, though, emotions lead to actions, which leads to decisions. Those decisions are about us. When we see people in our families having an emotion and then taking an action, destructive, hostile, verbally hurtful, and that sort of thing, And we take these same kind of actions, or we interpret these actions about being about us, they can lead us to make decisions not only about ourselves, about other people, about life, about God, etc. And if we decide on our own, or with the criticism of others, that our very beingness, our very existence, the fact that we are, is to blame for the negative consequences of the actions, we will use those negative emotions about ourselves and others in life to dictate our future actions or not action. We have an inventory of comparison material. And who doesn't? That is, we have memories that we compare our present time circumstances or patterns or situations to, in an effort to understand what is going on so we can figure out how to take or not take actions that will produce the results that we want. If I said to you, go out and play in the middle of interstate traffic, what we would do on hearing a statement like that is instantaneously we would compare those words to the images, not only the visual images, the auditory images, the kinesthetic images that we have in our comparison material about play, about in traffic, interstate, and we would very quickly recognize that's not an action that we're going to take. We would refuse to take that action. As children, we don't really have the comparison material. So when we get fed information that is not valid, not helpful, not positive, not useful, we don't have any way to compare it to anything else because our comparison material inventory is relatively sparse. We accept stuff at the face of it as being valid, particularly if it comes from people who we are in a position to trust, like parents, adults, authority figures, and so on. Let's just take a look at this, almost like a sequence of events. Emotions, and this is how I've diagrammed it, emotions with an arrow leading to action, with an arrow leading to decisions, leading to, with an arrow to emotions, with an arrow leading to action, with an arrow leading to decision, with an arrow leading to emotion. And while I have it written as a line, it's really a loop that goes around and around and around. It can be a spiral. It can be a spiral going in one direction or another. If the emotion is high vibration, which means the action is apt to be effective, the decision that we are enough, fill in the blank, enough, good enough, smart enough, kind enough, thoughtful enough, skillful enough, then we will have an empowering stream of energy to tap into. So that spiral, that loop is going upward, and we go to a higher and higher level of effectiveness, a higher vibration, feel better about ourselves and others and life. If, on the other hand, the emotion is a lower vibration, it will start to lead to actions that are less effective, to decisions that we handled that situation poorly. Therefore, the conclusion would be, we start to feel that we're not blank enough, we're not smart enough, good enough, talented enough, intelligent enough, or something, and that we will have created a disempowering wall of energy that will seek to, and we will use it to, block our future actions. We would have underpowered ourselves. We would have literally disempowered ourselves by starting ourselves on a downward spiral, by interpreting our actions in that way. Let's look at regret. There are a bunch of definitions of regret. Regret could be defined, and this is how I'll do it, as an emotion that is connected to a thought that, quotes, I wish I could pull back my energy from that action, or another variation, the flip side of that, I wish I could add my energy to that not action. Regret doesn't feel good. It's not supposed to feel good. It's supposed to be a bump in the road that signals to us a need to adjust our future actions, not our past actions. Our past actions are past. They occurred. We're not going to adjust them by being regretful. We're going to use that regret as information that will facilitate more effective choices in the future. The trouble with most of this, and most of us, is that we judge our being, and I'm going to use these concepts of being, capital B, doing, capital D, and having, capital H, as a way to look at these three major concepts. The trouble with most of us is that we judge our beingness, our existence, when we have regret, instead of judging our doingness. Really, it is the doing that this is about. If our doing is less than effective, we can use the feedback or the consequences as information to judge our doing. Oh, I did X, next time I'm going to do Y. When we use the doing to negatively judge our being, that's when we can get stuck in a downward spiral. When we judge ourselves to be the problem is us. We are naturally going to limit what we can be. We're going to, what we will allow ourselves to do, and by extension, when we limit our being and our doing, we are limiting what we can have in our lives. Part of the power, the negative power of action hyphen regret, is the sequence in which we make it about us. And there's a tendency in children to make this things about us, even when they're about other people. You know, many other psychologists who have recognized talking to children of divorces that the children almost invariably take responsibility for having caused the divorce. They think it's their doingness resulted in the unhappiness of their parents. And consequently, the parents got divorced because the child didn't pick up their clothes or didn't make their bed or didn't get all A's or didn't eat their spinach or some other behavior like that. The child will accept responsibility that their doing caused this unhappiness that resulted in divorce. And that kind of belief is reinforced through a lot of our training and our education. Since many of us got lots of negative feedback when our actions resulted in consequences or sounds or sights that our parents or others saw as not appropriate, as bad, and so on. And so we've learned over the years, over the course of our lives, to use the pain of this emotion, this feedback, this stuff that our parents blamed us for, to draw conclusions about ourselves, largely about our not blank enoughness. And because we hold that as part of our beingness, as part of our identity, we start limping through lives not being aware that we have so much more capabilities than we've been led to believe. When we look at something, that is, when we process any environmental signal, whether it's through our eyes by looking at something or listening through our ears or any of our other senses, and we use it to conclude negative things about ourselves, lives, other people, possibilities, we can get into trouble because we are distorting all kinds of possible realities. At a traffic light the other day, when my wife and I were driving, across the street was a beautiful, light blue Bentley convertible. So the fact is, we were sitting at that stoplight, and they were on the other side of the road, stopped coming, headed toward us. And the fact is, we were processing environmental signals by noticing it. I noticed it right away. And you can tell that I'm already judging the cars, because even without noticing it when I first thought of that, I consider it a beautiful car. A beautiful car. Beautiful is a judgment. It's a car. It's a car. It's an energy pattern that we recognize as a car. The fact that I labeled it beautiful was my judgment. If I stopped there, I wouldn't have any problem. However, if I started to compare my car to that car, I can notice a lot of things. So I could view some of the comparison of my car to that Bentley as positive, and I could also be able to compare my car to that Bentley in a negative way to make myself feel bad. Neither one of those is a necessary part of the process. I could just look at that car and admire it without going into the judging myself relative to it, either myself positively relative to it or myself negatively relative to it. If I judged myself negatively, for instance, that my previous actions in my life must have been inadequate, otherwise I could have afford a car like that as well. And because I can't, that must mean something bad about me. That is a very easy place for lots of people to go to, not in the case of a Bentley, because that's an extreme example of a car. The average person, number one, doesn't have it. Number two, doesn't want it, doesn't consider that an ideal goal. By the way, it wouldn't fit in my garage, so that pretty much eliminates me putting it on my things I want list. But if we make it about us and we compare ourselves negatively to it, we can produce a level of regret about our past actions. The other night, standing in a long line at a Dairy Queen, I saw an excited dog with its owners, a man and a woman, up ahead in the line. Right ahead of me at that point was a grandfather and a 5-year-old grandson. So I said to the son, grandson, I bet that dog is going to get some ice cream too. And the grandfather said, oh, that's funny, I just said the same thing. The man continued talking. I had a dog once, and he loved ice cream. I would eat my ice cream cone down toward the bottom, and when I neared the bottom, I would give the very bottom of the cone to my dog. He loved that. One day I was eating an ice cream cone, and just before I got near to the bottom, my dog ran across the street, as he often did, only this time my neighbor was driving down the road and hit him and killed him. I felt terrible that I didn't give him that ice cream cone that day. I looked at him and asked, regret? He said, yes, regret, to this day. This conversation came right out of the blue, no pun intended about the blue. I'd been writing about the connection between action and regret for a couple of days, so I must have attracted this conversation. And when I think of it, when I got into this line, this man and his grandson were 4 or 5 people ahead of us. And what happened in this Dairy Queen line is the people between him and us moved. They connected and joined other people further up in the line. So then all of a sudden, the grandfather and I were standing next to one another having this conversation. About 14 years ago, when I lived in California, San Diego, I was talking to my younger brother, George, who lives in New York. And we were talking on the phone, and in that conversation, it arrived at the point where he said he hated the feeling of being responsible for another person's unhappiness. I told him I felt the same exact way. That is really a very painful thing to feel. I often thought about that conversation since then and wondered how we were made responsible for other people's unhappiness and other people's happiness. We must have gotten trained to connect our actions to other people's unhappiness and happiness, and on that basis, connected regret to our actions. Now, today, I'd say, based upon my theory of management by disapproval, I can see that when our parents felt good about themselves, our behaviors were more acceptable. When they didn't feel self-accepting, they didn't express acceptance of us either. Here we were, a family of seven children, or how about seven mice, trying to push the right button in order to get to cheese. By cheese, I mean approval or acceptance or to see some indication of our parents' happiness. But the buttons weren't wired in a predictable way. When the button doesn't produce a predictable result through pushing it, that is, when our actions don't produce predictable results, it's crazy-making. And when an action or a behavior one day is adorable, but the next day is hellish, that is really very difficult for a child to make sense of. When we attribute the unhappiness to our actions instead of to other people's filters, we put ourselves at effect. We give up our causativeness because of the fears of their unhappiness. We're like, oh, I gotta be careful, walk on eggshells. Have you ever felt that or heard that expression? And it's this trying not to break those eggshells because that would be a really bad thing, resulting in unhappiness of other people, and then we would end up regretting it. The other thing that we do is we give up our causativeness when we fear the pain of regret. If that regret is going to be so painful that we just stop our actions entirely, we put on the brakes, that is a real problem for our productivity. Regret, like all the rest of the emotions, can be valid and helpful because they really serve as feedback. They serve as feedback. They're designed for helping us adjust future actions by learning from that experience. Let's say I walk into a wall and I regret having done that. That would be normal. The real question becomes, what is it that I regret? Do I regret walking? I hope not. Do I regret having walls? No, probably not. They're convenient when you have a building or a house or a room. Do I regret being me? That would be terrible, but a lot of our training leads us in that direction. Or do I use the experience of regret to reevaluate the situations that led me to walk into the wall in the first place? How could I use this experience for training or learning to avoid a larger regret later in life? That's a much more empowered way to evaluate that experience or to see that regret. There's an old saying, sometimes a stumble saves a fall. That idea can be really helpful because it can lead us to be thankful for these small mishaps, because those small mishaps can teach us something. They can help us to become aware of certain things that maybe we had overlooked before, and they can, because of that increased information, that increased wisdom or knowledge, help us to avoid or prevent a larger problem in the future. The real problem is when, with regret, is when we conclude that our doing, that is, our actions, are evidence of our being bad. To me, this is a terrible distortion, and it is not true. Think of regret this way. Regret is the emotion we experience when we don't have enough information and skill to cause desirable results. I think that's worth repeating. Regret is the emotion we experience when we don't have enough information or skill to cause desirable results. Now, a person who doesn't experience regret has been labeled various things in our society, like a sociopath or a psychopath. I'm not talking about them or to them. So, regret is really contingent upon lack of information or lack of skill. So the problem is not with us not with our being. The problem is lack of information and lack of skill. So if regret or the possibility of regret spurs us to seek more information or to acquire more skill, then this emotion of regret would be serving us very well. If we incorrectly link regret to our very being, capital B, the tendency then is to put the brakes on our being. This is where we deny our being. We try to control our being. We feel our being. We think of our being as bad, sinful, evil, dark, and we will try to prevent us from doing bad things. And as a result of that, to me, this is what happens. We will prevent spirit from fully flowing to us and through us. I'd like to challenge the Garden of Eden story. When we consider that story in this light that I'm talking about now, do we think that Adam and Eve, if they had sufficient information and skills of discernment, they would have fallen for the words of the serpent? Of course they wouldn't. Of course they wouldn't. They lacked information and skills of discernment. To tragic consequences, the Bible says that man and woman were flawed because of their actions. Because of this evidence, their very beingness was flawed. I think this doctrine of man's sinfulness and defectiveness has been taught for centuries and has caused unbelievable levels of pain and horror in humankind. Instead of recognizing that the doing of Adam and Eve was based upon insufficient knowledge and skill, we accepted the blame as an universal flaw of humanity. We accepted the false connection of an ineffective doing based upon a lack of information and skill to a flawed beingness. What better way to destabilize another human being than to convince him or her that at the core they are bad? Isn't that just about the worst possible lie to perpetrate on people? I think it is. To me, this is a great time to open to the healing spirit of a loving God to erase the residue of this erroneous vibration of regret being connected to our beingness when it should never have been linked that way at all in our teachings, and open to the possibility that we are ever increasing in our effectiveness as we recognize our true connection to our God, the creator of all that is. I would like to end the service with a prayer. Father God, Mother God, Christ, the creator and connection to all that is, all good, all possibilities, all healing, all happiness, all joy, all success, all health. Help us to recognize, by virtue of our very being, we are expressions of you. Our bodies, which we use for doing, require training. And as we develop effectiveness in using our bodies and emotions and thoughts in order to produce desirable results, we are in alignment with you. And we recognize this is not a straight road, it's not a straight path, but in fact contains zigs and zags, ups and downs, backs and forths. And our effectiveness is largely contingent upon our self-acceptance, acceptance of you, our belief in your acceptance of us, and our acceptance of others. And if we're not willing to embrace those levels of acceptance, we are condemning ourselves to needless struggle and pain, stress and anxiety. Help us to know the truth of your gifts to us. that with information which we can gain by being open to it, invoking the help of you, spirit, angels, and others, we can truly know our relationship to you and your healing spirit. Thank you. It is so. Amen.